Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings the globe to your ears through original documentary storytelling. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Friday the 22nd of September, these are our main stories. After talks with President Biden at the White House, President Zelensky has said the US has agreed extra help to strengthen Ukraine's air defences against further Russian attacks. The media tycoon Rupert Murdoch is giving his son Lachlan control of his businesses. And Brazil's Supreme Court has ruled in favour of restoring territory to an indigenous group. Also in this podcast, how is this for the King's English?
Tout simplement, le Royaume-Uni sera toujours un des alliés les plus proches et un des meilleurs amis de la France.
More details on that to come. We begin, though, in Washington, D.C. The U.S. will give more help to Ukraine in the coming winter to help boost its air defences against Russian attacks. It's part of a package of measures announced after talks between the U.S. President Joe Biden and his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky, at the White House. During a tour of Washington, Mr. Zelensky also visited the U.S. Congress and met leaders at the Pentagon. It's all part of his continued diplomatic effort to maintain American support for the war against Russia. At the end of the White House talks, President Biden said the US remained committed to ensuring Ukraine's long-term security and deterring future threats against sovereignty and freedom.
That's what this is all about, the future of freedom. America can never, will never walk away from that. That's why 575 days later, we stand with Ukraine and will continue to stand with you, Mr. President.
Well, I spoke to our North America correspondent, Sean Dilley, and asked him if Mr. Zelensky has got what he wants.
It's at the moment not set in stone, Robin, of course, because the $24 billion that Joe Biden has been floating is by no means secure. He now needs to secure lawmakers on Capitol Hill that this is an investment they should make on top of just over $110 billion already over the past year and a half.
What about the relationship between Zelensky and Biden, but perhaps more importantly, those meetings on Capitol Hill, those political leaders there and at the Pentagon? How's that side of the relationship with the US going?
It's pretty awkward, Robin. There's no other way of putting it. Political support is waning. Republicans in particular argue that there is no US national security interest in continuing to support Ukraine's defences. Joe Biden has been pursuing a policy in office of strengthening European leaders. He's a big supporter of NATO, for instance, the body that Donald Trump had discussed withdrawing from the membership thereof. At the moment, Joe Biden does know that the $24 billion in additional aid that he would like to get through, ultimately, when all is said and done, is likely to get through, but Republicans are not going to want to do that without some major spending cuts in other areas.
And the prospect of a domestic government shutdown in a renewed row over US domestic budget, how's that going to influence the push from Zelensky for more funding from the US? Is that going to make the environment even more challenging?
Yeah, it won't impact in any way President Zelensky asking for more funding. You know, we heard him inside the Oval Office just up the road from where I'm speaking to you from now, Robin, saying that particularly in the area of air defences, it desperately needs that support. It's rather challenging for Joe Biden. He's now, through his colleagues in Congress, speaking to lawmakers on all sides of the House, saying that it's very much in the US national interest and it's the right thing to do. Not every Republican agrees with him.
Sean Dilley in Washington, D.C. Well, let's stay in the US, where Rupert Murdoch has announced that he's stepping down from running one of the world's most powerful media empires at the age of 92. He has demanded the ear of presidents and prime ministers along the way. Mr. Murdoch is leaving his role as chair of Fox and News Corp, with his eldest son Lachlan taking over. Mr. Murdoch started in local newspapers in his native Australia and spent more than 70 years developing his own brand of right-wing populist content. It gave him significant political influence, particularly in the US and Britain. On Thursday, the 92-year-old announced in a letter to staff that he had decided to transition from being chairman of Fox and News Corp. His words, of part of the letter, are voiced by a BBC producer.
Dear colleagues, I'm writing to let you all know that I've decided to transition to the role of Chairman Emeritus at Fox and News. For my entire professional life, I've been engaged daily with news and ideas, and that will not change. But the time is right for me to take on different roles, knowing that we have truly talented teams and a passionate, principled leader in Lachlan, who will become sole chairman of both companies.
Rupert Murdoch was frequently accused of misusing the power that his news outlets gave him. Speaking to the BBC back in the 1960s, he described the feeling of power he got from being a newspaper owner.
Of course one enjoys the feeling of power, although I think this question of the power of newspaper proprietors can be greatly overdone. We have more responsibility than power, I think. The newspaper can create great controversies, stir up arguments within the community, discussion, can throw light on injustices, just as it can do the opposite. It can hide things and be a great power for evil.
The British journalist and broadcaster Piers Morgan was in charge of the News of the World here in the UK. That's one of Rupert Murdoch's most influential newspapers before it was shut down over a phone hacking scandal back in 2011.
To me, Rupert Murdoch is the greatest media figure of my lifetime, possibly ever, in terms of his boldness, his vision, in terms of his reach around the world. And for me personally, the opportunity he gave me when he made me editor of his biggest selling newspaper in the world, aged 28, was an unbelievable opportunity.
Brian Stelter from the US magazine Vanity Fair has written extensively about Rupert Murdoch's controversial Fox News.
In some ways, this was inevitable. I mean, yes, Rupert Murdoch always said he would never retire. His son Lachlan always said his dad would never retire. But his companies have been shrinking over the years and struggling against the media headwinds that all media companies are facing. For example, streaming and the struggles of newspapers. So Rupert Murdoch is not the swashbuckling, feared and reviled media mogul that he once was, that he was for decades.
Well, that's the thoughts of Brian Stelter and before him, Piers Morgan. I spoke to our business correspondent, Erin Delmore, who's in New York City, and I asked her how the Murdoch news there has been received.
Whether or not you love him, there's been no denying over here that Rupert Murdoch is a defining influence on the U.S. media landscape and, in fact, has done more than many individuals to shape public opinion, especially on the right, the network where his news network, Fox, has found a political home. You know, there's been a lot of different talk today about what this means for the company and what's ahead. But in this moment, a lot of people are looking back on Murdoch's legacy and the way that he has shaped the way that news operates in the United States. Certainly, it's not so much a wild change for Fox itself, with Lachlan having had his hands on the wheel for a bit of time now. But it's just a moment to reflect on Murdoch's legacy as a whole.
Is he going to go quietly as part of this transition, or do you expect to hear from Rupert Murdoch in the weeks, months and years ahead?
Well, he made it known in the statement that he would be continuing to speak up, made a point to say that he's always taken a role in daily editorial, you know, the news happenings of the day. And that seems to be almost in his DNA at this point. It's hard to say how far this is a step back or a step out or what kind of influence he'll still exert. But he's been out and about and he's been reassuring folks that he's still going to be, you know, a visible presence here.
Now, we said at the beginning that along the way to constructing this huge empire, he's demanded the ears of presidents and prime ministers. Has there been any reaction from President Trump or others, other senior politicians on the news?
We're looking to see now. And part of what strikes me about the moment and the timing here is that we're about to get into a brand new political cycle here in the United States. And so certainly, yes, we can talk about the way that Rupert Murdoch's news organizations have amplified and elevated former President Trump's standing within the Republican Party. Again, someone who had been previously previously untested in politics, tested in the business world, but new to government and governance, and how much Fox News's coverage of him and endorsement and embrace of his policies and his message really fueled his base in 2016 and also in 2020. And the network has found itself embroiled in litigation, even paying out a $787 million settlement over its amplifications of the false claims made by President Trump about the 2020 election.
Erin Delmore reporting. Sudan's de facto leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, has told the United Nations General Assembly that war in his country could spill over into neighbouring African nations. He urged the international community to designate his opponents, the Rapid Support Forces, as a terrorist group. From New York, our diplomatic correspondent James Landell reports.
Thousands of Sudanese civilians have died in the fighting between the Rapid Support Force rebels and the Sudanese armed forces. Its leader, General al-Burhan, is on a diplomatic tour seeking international support. He warned the UN the conflict was now a threat to regional peace and stability. He also accused the RSF of war crimes, and he claimed he was willing to engage in peace talks. In a rare video appearance, the RSF leader, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti, said he too was prepared for a ceasefire. Similar statements by both sides have previously not led to any reduction in the fighting.
James Landell. Let's go to Brazil now. That was the reaction on Thursday to a ruling from Brazil's Supreme Court about restoring land to an indigenous group in the country. The decision in favour of the Xokleng people will set a precedent for hundreds of land claims. It's likely to define the future of land rights in South America's largest country. Katie Watson in Sao Paulo told me more.
Well, this is a long-standing case for the indigenous people of the Xokleng. So they're about 2,300 people who live in Santa Catarina, which is in the state of southern Brazil. Their troubles have been going on since the 19th and 20th centuries. They were victims of a really brutal land clearance. Many German settlers who came in and drove them off their land. So back in 1996, they were granted the rights to some land, but they argued that actually they were due much more because they actually had much more ancestral lands before they were driven from them. They were taken from them by force. Then it goes on to 2009 when they were evicted from an area that formed a nature reserve. They appealed this decision. And then in 2013, the authorities used this argument that's called the Marco Temporal, which means time frame in Portuguese. And effectively, the argument was that if the indigenous people wanted to lay claim to any land, they would have had to prove that they live on that land when the Brazilian constitution was signed in 1988. But they argued that completely ignored the fact that they'd been forcibly removed to make way for the settlers. So that's why they took their appeal all the way to the Supreme Court.
And am I right that in terms of this particular case, it pitted this indigenous group against the industrial farming complex? Is that right?
I mean, it's the story of Brazil and its land, yes. So there are a lot of indigenous groups on land that is very, seen as very valuable. We hear about deforestation in the Amazon all the time. That's exactly the same issue. The powerful farming lobbies in Brazil were pitted against the indigenous communities, which is something that, you often see. And there are a huge amount of court cases and conflicts over land rights. And that's what's so interesting about this case, is because of the fact that now this so-called time frame, Marco Temporal, has been swept away, it now could open up so many more cases.
So this is seen and this is regarded as a defining moment, is it, in terms of it setting a precedent going forward?
Absolutely. I mean, it's seen as a boost to indigenous rights. Of course, now the president is Lula da Silva. He made very clear in his campaign, and he's made clear in his previous time as president, the rights of indigenous people, the rights of land rights, are something that he feels very important. You compare that with far-right leader Jair Bolsonaro, who talked about the fact that indigenous rights had gone too far. He said he wouldn't give an inch more to indigenous communities who already had enough land. So it's a very different political landscape in Brazil. And of course, this is a huge win for indigenous communities, who are often seen as lacking the ability really to be able to fight their corner when you've got powerful farming lobbies arguing that they shouldn't be evicted from the land that they've worked for decades either.
Katie Watson in Sao Paulo. A BBC investigation has revealed that the social media app TikTok is driving online frenzies that encourage antisocial behaviour in the real world. Ex-employees of TikTok say the issue is not being tackled for fear of slowing the growth of the business. These frenzies, where TikTok drives disproportionate engagement in some topics, are evidenced by interviews with former staffers, app users, and BBC analysis of wider social media data. They've led to disruption and disorder in everyday life. The BBC's Mariana Spring has more.
Like everybody else on TikTok, I'm obsessed with this Idaho murder case.
What connects false accusations of murder in the US?
Where four students were brutally stabbed to death.
Amateur sleuths turning up in a British town. And antisocial behaviour and vandalism in UK schools. The answer is they are all examples of TikTok frenzies identified by the BBC. When you post a video on TikTok, it can be pushed to users everywhere on the For You page at a speed and scale that doesn't seem possible on other social media platforms, creating a frenzy of posts. Former employees and creators have told me how this design means people are seeing videos they normally would not see and being incentivized to behave in a harmful way to produce more popular content.
The search for mum of two, Nicola Bulley, continues 8 days after she went missing.
Nicola Bulley's disappearance earlier this year shocked the UK. An inquest ruled the 45-year-old died by accidental drowning, but conspiracy theories exploded on TikTok, with police saying it interfered with the investigation.
Hello.
Hi.
Lovely to meet you.
I travelled to Swansea to meet Heather. She ran one account racking up millions of views posting about the case, having never shared content like this on TikTok before. In one video, she falsely suggested footage of Nicola leaving the house on the morning of her disappearance was really her friend Emma. It received 3.6 million views.
Whenever you post something and it gains traction, TikTok will send you little emails of encouragement telling you that you've received this many views, you're a hit. If you post something and you receive a lot of positivity from it, I think that can definitely change your behaviour, whereas before you might not have had that level of empowerment or entitlement, and now all of a sudden you feel that you've got this authority to keep posting.
Heather regretted getting caught up in the frenzy, and without TikTok, she doesn't think she would have got involved in this way. Lucas, not his real name, is one of several TikTok ex-employees I spoke to for answers about these frenzies. He's voiced by an actor.
It grew so fast that they couldn't possibly keep up with or predicted every single where the app was going to go. And in general, they don't want to. They don't want to stand in the way of entertainment growing quickly on their platform. It's about money. The more users they have on the platform, spending more time watching videos, they can sell more ads, sell them for a higher price. It's probably the most addictive platform that we've encountered yet, and I think that's a real danger, especially because of how young the audience is and how impressionable they are.
TikTok told the BBC, "Our platform reflects conversations happening up and down the country and in the media. Our recommendation system is designed to prioritise safety, suggesting a range of content, proactively interrupting repetitive patterns, and reducing the reach of videos containing unverified information." Speaking to ex-employees and users, it seems that these frenzies are difficult to keep up with, and it's hard to know when and where the next one will happen.
That report from the BBC's disinformation and social media correspondent, Mariana Spring. Still to come.
There's nothing like 100% pure Florida quality orange juice with the vitamins, minerals and taste that make you feel so good.
But why has the cost of orange juice in many parts of the world been increasing?
I had just come out of one of my bare knuckle boxing matches. I don't know why, but the first thing that came to my brain was, what if I do a drag show?
Remarkable personal stories told by the people that lived them.
I could easily have pulled that trigger, but that was not my brief. I was not an assassin. I was not told to do that. I was not told to murder him.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Now, the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has urged India to cooperate with an investigation into the murder of a Canadian Sikh activist. His claim earlier this week that the Indian government may have been involved in the killing on Canadian soil has triggered a furious diplomatic row between the two countries. On Thursday, Mr. Trudeau insisted that he wasn't seeking to provoke Delhi. India, though, has halted visa services in Canada and called for a reduction in Canadian diplomatic staff based in India. Mr. Trudeau said the killing in June of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil was of the utmost seriousness.
We call upon the government of India to take seriously this matter and to work with us to shed full transparency and ensure accountability and justice in this matter. We are a country of the rule of law. We are going to continue to do the work necessary to keep Canadians safe and to uphold our values and the international rules-based order.
I heard more from our correspondent in Delhi, Zubair Ahmed.
The relations between two democracies and two friends were tense earlier, but now it seems like it's turning out into a full-blown diplomatic crisis. In the afternoon here, the Indian government said that it wanted Canada to downsize its diplomatic corps in India, citing alleged interference by Canadian diplomats in what they said India's internal affairs. It also said that the Canadian diplomats in India were much larger in number. What they want is parity in numbers and also in ranks. And that's why we will see in the next couple of days lots of Canadian diplomats leaving India.
Are there signs in the media coverage there over the past few days that India regards this as something very, very serious? Or what's the kind of talk been where you are about these accusations?
Well, India is feeling quite upset and even angry. Many Indians, especially the former diplomats who are coming on the Indian channels and Indian newspapers, they're all very upset that the Canadian Prime Minister will go public with his accusation that India was behind the killing of a Sikh Canadian citizen in the month of June this year. The feeling here is that India is not going to back down. I just spoke to a governing BJP ruling party member, and he said that the instructions are that, you know, we have to be very strong and we have to give Canada back in its own coin.
You refer to some former diplomats. You say they're upset. Are they upset because they don't believe the accusation made by Justin Trudeau, or are they upset because he's chosen to make it public?
It's both. Many of the ruling party ex-diplomats who have joined the party now, they say that the accusations are untrue. But there are some who believe that it was right for Mr. Trudeau, when he came to attend the G20 summit in Delhi, to confide in Mr. Modi and complain to him in private, which he did. And he should not have gone public with his accusations.
Zubair Ahmed speaking to me from Delhi. The BBC is facing fresh allegations about the conduct of the British comedian and actor Russell Brand. A woman has come forward to accuse him of exposing himself to her and then joking about it on his BBC radio show. Russell Brand has denied recent accusations of rape and sexual assault from four women between 2006 and 2013. He has yet, though, to respond to these new claims. The BBC has said it's very sorry to hear of the allegations, and we'll look into them. From Los Angeles, here's our North America correspondent, Nomia Iqbal. And a warning, her report contains some graphic details.
The woman who has made the complaint had never come forward before, but was prompted to speak out when the allegations about Russell Brand emerged at the weekend. She says the incident happened when the comedian and broadcaster was in the BBC's office in Los Angeles to record his Radio 2 show in 2008. She was working for another company which shared the office space and had opened the front door to him and his team after the doorbell kept ringing unanswered. Sometime later, she was in a communal bathroom when she says Russell Brand entered the room and exposed himself to her. We've asked an actor to speak her words.
And then he said, "Well, I'm going to f*** you." And I went, "What?" And he goes, "I'm going to f*** you." And I said, "No, you're not." He was wearing black harem pants, which are pants that have an elasticized waist. And he pulled out his penis on his hand and pretty much served it to me. And he would be, you know, as you would be serving someone some food.
The woman said his team then banged on the door and he went out to record his show. She said she was left feeling ashamed but didn't make a formal complaint despite many people knowing what had happened. However, in recent days, she heard the broadcast for the first time when Russell Brand and his co-host Matt Morgan had gone on to laugh about the incident moments after she says it happened.
I won't be able to drag her off into a cubicle and show her my pubicles. That would never
How
do.
Long ago did you do that last?
Been a long while, Matt, since old Russie
Brown. 25 minutes since he showed his willy to a lady.
Very easy to judge.
You're a receptionist.
Look, if you... Like,
receive this!
Am I supposed to ring that little bell with my finger? Have
he you got ever told off for ringing a bell. Ever? Minutes later, he was showing his willy.
The woman, who was not in fact a receptionist but did work in the shared office, says she's stunned this exchange was broadcast.
What made the BBC think that was appropriate to go out like that? I just don't understand why they didn't investigate this much sooner, given the raunchy, outrageous bits that I have heard, and I suspect of his radio show. And I suspect there's far worse in all those episodes that I can't even stomach to listen to them.
She said nobody from BBC News management approached her directly, and no formal action was taken, even after a BBC staff member had disclosed the incident to senior executives in 2019.
Nomia Iqbal in Los Angeles, and we've since had a statement from Russell Brand's former co-presenter Matt Morgan, who you heard in that clip from a radio show. In the statement, he said, "I stopped working with Russell Brand several years ago. During the time I worked with him, I was never aware of any allegations of serious sexual misconduct against him. I am regretful to learn that a show I was part of made colleagues uncomfortable at times." And you can see more of that statement and this story at BBC News Online. You're listening to the Global News Podcast. Now let's go to France and the visit of a very famous Englishman and his address to the French Parliament.
Tout simplement, le Royaume-Uni sera toujours un des alliés les plus proches et un des meilleurs amis de la France.
That was, you've guessed it, King Charles on the second day of his state visit, in which he said, and I'm translating here for you, quite simply, the United Kingdom will always be one of France's closest allies and best friends. Well, the King and his wife Queen Camilla have also viewed reconstruction work at Notre Dame Cathedral. Hugh Schofield sent this report from Paris.
Before even he'd begun speaking, the King was honoured with applause from the parliamentarians gathered in the ornate Senate chamber inside the 17th century Palais de Luxembourg. It was the first time in history that a British monarch had given a speech in either of the chambers of the French Parliament. Combining sections in French with sections in English, the King spoke of his devotion to France, inherited from his mother, and pledged to use his reign to work to reinforce what he called our indispensable relationship. On Ukraine and the environment, it was vital, he said, that France and the UK worked hand in hand.
These horrifying events have once more demonstrated the fragility of so much that we hold dear. Just as we stand together against military aggression, so must we strive together to protect the world from our most existential challenge of all, that of global warming, climate change, and the catastrophic destruction of nature.
There was another standing ovation at the end. Later, the King and Queen met sports people in the suburb of Saint-Denis.
Can we interrupt you on your trip?
No, well, we've got a day off today.
And at Notre Dame, they met firefighters who were at the blaze that ravaged the cathedral 4 years ago, and craftsmen and women who are helping in the reconstruction. The King and Queen fly to Bordeaux in the southwest for the last leg of their state visit.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Now, let's end on a glass of orange juice. It's a staple of every breakfast table. But recently, the cost of a glass has gone up because crop sizes have gone down. Both Brazil, the world's largest orange supplier, and the US state of Florida, which accounts for more than 90% of the country's supply, have been dealing with extreme weather events. There was Hurricane Ian at the end of last summer, then there was cold weather over the winter, which has made it more difficult to grow the fruit. It sent so-called futures prices for orange juice to record highs, as Alex Bell has been finding out.
There's nothing like 100% pure Florida quality orange juice with the vitamins, minerals and taste that make you feel so good.
A television advertisement from the 1990s promoting the feel-good factor that comes from Florida's most famous fruit. Oranges are so beloved here that they're even featured on car license plates. But 30 years since that commercial aired, and growers aren't feeling so good about what lies ahead.
Florida has a lot of weather conditions that we have to combat, not only hurricanes, but also freezes, droughts, excessive rain.
Kyle Story's family has been farming citrus fruits for generations across hectares of land spread right across Florida. In 2022, their farms were hit by devastating hurricanes. And now there's another growing threat to contend with, a nasty bacterial disease known as greening.
We see citrus greening across all growing areas in Florida. It's a disease that affects each and every tree, unlike any other disease we've ever witnessed, certainly in my lifetime. It infects any type of variety, whether that be oranges, or grapefruit, limes, lemons. And in the last 2 to 3 years, it has taken its toll. Not only have our inputs, our costs gone up over double and in some cases triple, our production has gone down. And quite frankly, after the hurricanes of 2022, we saw our production hit historical lows.
But away from the farmlands, a financial phenomenon has been engulfing the orange juice industry, and it all sounds a little familiar.
We are commodities brokers, William. Commodities are agricultural products.
In the 1983 film Trading Places, Eddie Murphy finds himself swept up in the world of futures trading, making big bucks short-selling frozen orange juice concentrate. Orange juice itself portrayed in the film as an American symbol of wealth and opportunity. And it's a story ringing true today, because the problems facing farmers like Kyle have sent orange juice futures to an all-time high over summer. I spoke to Matt Joyner, CEO of Florida Citrus Mutual, a trade association which works with citrus farmers.
The futures market is a pricing mechanism that's forward-looking on what we think the value of FCOJ, or frozen concentrate orange juice, will be in the future. And they're used to hedge pricing on your crops and, of course, by traders just for general trading.
And so why our futures a hot topic right now?
The reason there's so much discussion around the futures market right now is because the future price or the projected price of orange juice is going up. And we're seeing that because we're seeing a decrease in the production of oranges over the past 18 years from about 250 million boxes of oranges down to roughly 16 million boxes this past season. And so when you're seeing that kind of a decrease in volume, obviously the price of that commodity is going to go up.
So is this, as is often the case, a chance for savvy market traders to cash in on a difficult time for thousands of farmers? Well, not exactly. Many are banking on the humble orange to make a comeback, including farmer Kyle.
As a farmer, I have to be a natural optimist. As a business person, I have to be realistic. We no doubt have unprecedented challenges facing us today. But what we see with new therapies that are being deployed over the last 8 to 10 months, the citrus trees are recovering at a rate that is very encouraging, very promising for us to continue to responsibly invest in the future. Is every citrus grower or every citrus grove going to make it? No, but we feel confident in the future of the continuing economic impact that we have in our state and in our country.
That report from Alex Bell. Well, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can, of course, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Oblakwa. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thanks for listening.